Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Before the 92nd South Dakota legislative session began, In the Moment reached out to members of the incoming class of lawmakers for perspective. Now we revisit a few of those folks for a recap. Today we welcome back Representative Greg Jamieson from District 12. He's sitting across the table from me now in the studios at the University of Sioux Falls, where the building is packed with students and the parking lot is packed with snow, but you made it through all that to get here. Thanks, Greg.
You bet. My pleasure to be here.
All right. So you're back in town, obviously. Are you all wrapped up? Or are you still following things? What sort of part in the process are you personally at with the State House?
Sure. There's one day left scheduled for the 27th, which is a veto day, if we should need to override any of the governor's vetoes, if he vetoes any of our bills. So that day is left. Otherwise, there's some summer studies that are getting put together, some things like that that'll be determined later, and what will happen, what issues will be discussed or studied, so to speak, over the summer is yet to be determined, but that'll come here shortly, and then that'll start unfolding pretty soon.
All right, so you are an experienced lawmaker, but this is your first time in Pierce, so give me a little bit of an idea of how was it different. Was it what you expected, and how is it just the same as work with a city or a county?
Sure. Well, you know, before I went, I was full of anticipation and excitement, you know, not knowing what's it's like going to college a little bit, you know,
right.
Not knowing who your new friends are going to be, where your classes are going to be, all that kind of stuff. Well, but now afterwards, it's been quite an eye-opener, quite an experience, quite a learning experience for me. I've gained a ton of perspective on how things come together, how the state works compared to the city, and how they work together, and with the counties, and all that kind of how it all comes together. It's been a little bit like drinking from a fire hydrant hose, right, or whatever, a fire hose. And but at the end of the day, it's a great experience, great learning experience for me.
Can you explain that to me?
Well, so
how the state and the city and the county is, you know, dividing those responsibilities and stuff. Is there an easy answer, or is that just an ongoing sort of debate of, you know, philosophical debate as well?
Right. So the ongoing discussion really is about local control,
yeah,
and who is really better off controlling government. Is it the state? Is it the county? Is it the cities within those counties? And that seems to be our fight all the time, is about really who should make this decision. Should the state legislature make it on behalf of all those counties and school or cities and even schools,
right,
and to say we know better than the rest of you? Or do we kind of give them the ability to make their own decision, and then from there it unfolds with local representation, even though legislators are local as well? But together, collectively, we act on the state behalf, where, you know, local government or for a county or for a city, they're all elected right from that one area. So anyway, that's kind of the big fight, is how do you keep those other governmental bodies in control and not try to overstep them? Because
right,
it's a pretty easy tendency to try to overstep them and say, oh, we'll get this.
And then money must come into play then, too. Who pays for it versus who has control of it? That has to be another huge sort of philosophical struggle, and, you know, down to the brass tacks of how things are going to get done.
Right. So, like, you've heard of these things called unfunded mandates,
mm-hmm,
and where the state passes a new law and the county generally has to then execute those new procedures or practices, but we don't give them any money to help them do that. And then so the county has to take within their own resources and abilities and now implement a new process or procedure to follow the state law. And that's where the rub starts to occur, is if they've got to now start spending more money and they already don't have enough money to do what they need to do,
right,
and then the state kind of piles it on. So that's a struggle.
All right. So you brought your Scooby-Doo lunchbox to Pierre. Last time I talked to you, we were talking about Initiated Measure 22,
right,
and having to pack your own lunch because you
exactly
couldn't get that free soup and grilled cheese sandwich anymore.
Right.
I don't know. I'm being facetious. But so let's talk about Initiated Measure 22.
Sure.
Are you sort of satisfied with the legislation that that the State House put forth to address some of the big concerns of voters? Or do you think there's much more work to be done? What are your thoughts on how that all developed?
So there's a couple pieces left to be done, and one of them is realigning or setting the campaign finance contribution levels and limits. And we got most everything else kind of filled in what we at least thought was important to replace for IM-22. But there are a couple pieces we didn't get finished because either we ran out of time or we kind of came to head on conflicts of what one party wanted and what the other party wanted. And so that's one of those items that's going to get extended into the summer study. One of the items we're going to do is discuss exactly what those limits should be. Should we adjust them up or down, or where they should be, really settle on it. So that's a piece that's undone and left. But otherwise, you know, we got a lot of things settled, like the lobbying gifts, a limit, $100, which seems pretty reasonable. Ethics reform based on an ethics commission type, I guess that they call it a governmental accountability board. But either way, it's intended to provide guidance on individuals so they can know if they've done something wrong, what the process is going to be, how to work through that. Let's see. Then there were other issues, too. But, you know, one thing that was in IM-22 that we didn't touch or didn't even address was the government-funded campaigns. We just never even went there. Nobody in either party advocated for a bill promoting that part of it. So we never even touched it, never reviewed it, never considered it.
How do you feel about that? Smart decision, you think, because of the financial impact of the budget, or you think it's an oversight that really needs to be looked at during the summer study?
No, I'm satisfied with it. Most people who've talked to me about the whole IM-22 issue never brought that piece of it up. They all talked about lobbyist reforms and campaign finance reforms and ethics. And we've addressed those major issues. But nobody ever really pressed me and said, hey, we need more government funding for your campaign. Nobody did that. And so I think that was just a piece of it that a lot of people probably didn't even know that was in there. And so yeah, I think we're good.
The other thing I remember us talking about before the session started was you represent District 12. This is Sioux Falls, and Sioux Falls, you said, is often the elephant in the room in Pierre. And I think I remember you saying everybody likes to kick the elephant.
Yeah,
so how did that sort of play out this year? Did you, you know, find a way to navigate that and represent your constituents, but also do so in a way that made sense for the rest of the state?
I did. You know what the term they called me was? Flatlander. So the guys from West River, you know, teased me about being a flatlander and far more moderate than they are, you know. But I built some great friendships. I met a lot of great people I would have never met before, and I think I was a pretty good ambassador for Sioux Falls, reaching out to the rest of those across the state. You know, I guess they had seen me. A lot of here's funny. A funny thing is they would say, hey, I've seen you on TV before, or I know your name, or I've known you, but I've never met you. And so that always was a nice way to open the door. But they were all real friendly. I would say I didn't run in. I'm scanning my brain to remember, but I don't think I ran into anybody who was really adamantly opposed to Sioux Falls. But what I learned is when I say something on the floor or in a committee meeting about how we did things in Sioux Falls, I had to approach that pretty cautiously and not say, in the big city, this is how we do it. Right. I would have to kind of, you know, tailor that to say, what I learned over the years was this, you know. And you need to avoid saying, in Sioux Falls, this is how we do it, because that doesn't help.
Does it not translate, though? I mean, is there a legitimate reason for that some things that worked in Sioux Falls might not work in, you know, Lemon or Isabel or Custer or somewhere else? Or is it more of just a matter of bridging the sort of population gap and impressions?
Well, there's a lot of bridges to be built, and I think there's a lot of misconceptions people have about Sioux Falls people. At least from the west of us. Mm-hmm. Seems like everywhere west of Sioux Falls. It used to be West River, but now it's everywhere west of Sioux Falls. But, you know, everything happens in Sioux Falls. Sioux Falls generates a lot of revenue for the state. A lot of other elected people from Sioux Falls or live in Sioux Falls. Sioux Falls gets all the attention, that kind of thing. But one thing that kind of carries through is other places of the parts of the state would think that some new issue that was coming up was going to create a huge problem for them. And we would illustrate, well, in Sioux Falls, it actually doesn't create a problem for us because here's how we handle it. And they would have never seen the kind of numbers that we would have had to deal with in Sioux Falls. And then they can relate, oh, well, then it probably isn't going to be a problem for us because what we thought would be a big problem for us and even a bigger problem for Sioux Falls apparently isn't. So there's some guidance we can give that way. I would tell you, though, there's probably from the opposite side, the smaller communities who are struggling to fund the purchase of a new motor grader or something like that, where Sioux Falls has great resources and can do a lot of those things, those other communities are struggling to do just some basic things. And so you have to sometimes realign yourself and put yourself in their shoes and then try to find solutions for them. Hmm. Trying to work together.
What did you learn from them, from some of those smaller communities who might be more financially strapped that you thought you could really apply to the city of Sioux Falls?
Sure. Well, one thing I learned right away is that they are far more conservative than we are.
Politically, socially, financially?
Keep going.
Keep going. Okay.
Everywhere.
Okay.
Everywhere. So yeah. It is amazing what I thought was a conservative approach to running government. You know, they've got a whole nother term for it. And so you would think, you know, maybe just adding some more money or you could find a way to fund it. Well, no, smaller communities, you can't. And they've had to live for years and years and years without any new revenues and trying to make it work. So those guys have been through the fight thick and thin all the time of making it stretch out. So we're trying to put together, say, the state budget, and all of a sudden now we're cutting and trying to find ways to make it work. And all those others from all across the rest of the state, they've been there before. Well, you know, in Sioux Falls, we've had the luxury of having decent revenue increases and finding a way of making it work because our revenues are up. Well, the rest of the state, it's not the case. And so what I've learned is that what I thought was conservative isn't conservative. So I'm recalibrating, I should say.
And it's interesting because we had another lawmaker who was a freshman lawmaker, Tim Goodwin from, I forget the district, but Custer, Hot Springs,
30s,
that area.
Yeah.
And he said he was surprised at how liberal the state house was compared to what, you know, he really felt there weren't as many true conservatives there. So a wide range of perspectives in the state. And I don't know that we ever really give ourselves credit for our diversity in political thought in this state. That could be a real asset, although it's also a challenge.
So Tim Goodwin is one of those guys that I met. He sits right in front of me, and he is one of those guys who calls me a flatlander. And so you're right. So you consider the guys from Sioux Falls maybe being more liberal, like, you know, even though we're moderate, I suppose, and then you have the far more conservative individuals to the west of us. But collectively as a state, we are very conservative compared to other states. Mm. So it's just an interesting eye-opener of how it all really comes together.
Sure. Legislation that you brought forward, transparency legislation, as I recall. I didn't follow through to find out what happened to that. What were you trying to address and what happened?
Right. So here's a good insight from a big city kid coming into Pierre thinking he's got it all figured out. So I brought a bill, I think it was 1166, and the proposal was to require that all settlements, essentially civil or criminally, needed to be in open records, so you couldn't file them confidentially without a court order. And the intent there was to provide more transparency into everything we're doing as a government and to avoid situations where deals are made and secrets are kind of kept, and if it's the government's money, if it's the public's money and we're spending it, the public has a right to know, and we shouldn't keep it a secret. So I bring that into committee, you know, thinking, yeah, this is the answer, and a lot of people liked it, but I went too far with it, and there were 9 different bodies who came and testified in opposition of it. So on the surface, it sounds like a great idea, but at the end of the day, there were a lot of pieces to it that created problems or conflicts, and I hadn't worked through those. And those individuals who came and testified made that crystal clear, and so it died an immediate death. But some of them who did testify against it gave me language to revise it so I could bring it back and still make a good bill out of it and still do good work with it. So I intend to do that. There was one, 1165, that did pass. It went through both bodies without any no votes. and that's 1165. And that's regarding the campaign finance financial interest disclosure statements. And the requirement now is that every person every year has to fill it out, who's ever been elected, I guess, while they're elected. It used to be you only did it once. And legislators running every 2 years would have to file them every other year. But say if you were elected to a six-year term or a four-year term, you'd only have to do it once. Well, this requires you do it every year, mm-hmm. and even if you're not running for re-election. So in the intent there is to give voters an idea of who you are, where you get your money, and it just helps improve transparency. And that's a little bit of IM22's direction, was to provide better clarity and transparency in the election process.
Can you give us any insight into some of the final days, some of those hot button issues, mm-hmm. I'm going to call it the protest bill, because I can't remember the number of the bill that sort of helps the state respond to something like what happened in North Dakota with pipeline protests. Some of that was right down to the wire, as is the budget always. Any insight into some of that last minute negotiation or mm-hmm. wrangling?
Well, it's very interesting. You're following this very well. So you're right. It was new to me, the whole process of voting on a bill and having it die. And immediately following, the sponsor would request a reconsideration. And then that put it into kind of a stall mode. And people would be scrambling around trying to negotiate a deal on how to represent it with a new amendment. And then with the new amendment, it would pass. And so we did that a couple of times with that bill, and then it would go over to the Senate, and they would have to consider it. They would do something similar and add an amendment and send it back to us, and we're like, well, wait a minute, that's not right. But a lot of negotiating on that particular bill about the emergency clause, putting it into place immediately versus waiting until July, because some of the, you couldn't refer it then if it's an immediate emergency clause provision, and you couldn't enact some of those authorities given to the governor if you waited until July and there was a protest that happened in the state of South Dakota prior to July. So the governor had a push that he was putting on. Others were pushing back on the proposal because they wanted the governor to listen to their concerns about the constitutional carry discussion that the governor is threatening to veto. And there was trying to negotiate a little bit. I know they were up, that's what they were up to, but they didn't really want to kind of say it that way. And the governor's office, of course, doesn't really work that way. But the intent was to get the governor's attention. And I think at the end of the day, there were some communications that occurred. I don't know about any deals, but at the end of the day, it was, hey, man, hey, governor, we really want you to listen to what we're concerned about. Don't override our vote with a veto. And so anyway, it's a, like I told others, I said, I've seen a lot of sausage made in my day, but I've never seen it made like this. Quite amazing.
Yeah. Well, that one's still really in development then, because as we wait for those vetoes. Greg Jamieson, thanks for coming back.
Well, you
Next
bet.
Year, what are you looking forward to?
Well, getting a couple other bills finalized, revamped, and settled. Now I know who the players are, kind of, and I know the lay of the land, so I think I can maneuver through there faster. This year was a lot of, wide-eyed and listening and not wanting to get in the way. And I made a couple of blunders, and I can get past those and really get right into it again. So next year should be exciting, too.
All right. Greg Jamieson from District 12.